What's up, Farewell listeners? I'm your host, Clay Skipper. You are listening to Farewell. Today we have a special edition roundtable. It is between myself, Clay Skipper, Brad Stahlberg, and friend of the Growth Equation, Cal Newport. If you recognize the name Cal Newport, it might be from one of his many best-selling books, or it might be because he's a name we often mention on the podcast. But over the last couple decades, there are few people who have thought as hard about technology and work and productivity as Cal. He's a computer scientist by training. He got a PhD from MIT and he teaches at Georgetown. But as you'll hear him explain today when he goes into his story, when he was in college, he also decided he wanted to be a writer. So while still in college, he started writing about study habits for college kids who wanted to be better students. He wrote his first couple books right around the time he was in college. And since then, that was about 20 years ago, he has become a staff writer for The New Yorker and written, again, numerous bestsellers about mostly how we can work more productively and effectively, but also more sustainably and sanely. And he talks about how we can best use technology to help rather than harm us. As a computer scientist, obviously, he's not anti-tech. He's just very thoughtful about using it intentionally. His books have included Deep Work, Digital Minimalism, and A World Without Email. And his latest book, Slow Productivity, became a New York Times bestseller. And it presents a pretty refreshingly sane idea, which is that we might be able to do more work and not be completely burnt out or exhausted doing it. So Cal is exactly the type of mind we are interested in tapping into on the show. He's not only studied how to do great work and do it sustainably and do it excellently for a long period of time, but he's also been doing it for two decades. Two decades of consistency and quality have led him to the successful place and platform he has now. So you may have heard us mention before this idea of the knowing-doing gap, the difference between knowing something in theory and being able to put it in practice. And Cal has proven that he obviously can bridge that gap. He not only studies how to work effectively, he puts it into practice. So we wanted to ask him about all that, his own story, his strategies, and the concepts in his new book about how we can all work while keeping our sanity in a world that is a little bit overloaded with technology and communication and things that are causing us to be burnt out and exhausted. And the final thing I'll say about Cal that I think gives him a bit of a universal appeal, whether or not you like to think about or talk about ways to work and productivity, is that he's just a really good systems level thinker. Whether you're someone who wants to be a more effective worker, or you're an athlete or a coach, or just someone who wants to get a little bit more organized in your life, the best way to do that is through having effective systems. And so hearing Cal talk about how he uses systems, I think will be very helpful to anybody who wants to be a little bit more effective and organized. And Brad joined me for this because Brad and Cal have become good friends. And I think it was great to have an interview with Brad as well. Gives a new and interesting dynamic. So here is Brad in my interview with Cal Newport. I want to start with something that has nothing to do with digital tools, digital life, technology at all. I want to ask about your sports background because we have a lot of athletes who listen to this podcast. You were a wrestler, a rower, and a sprinter. Do I have that right?
Not a wrestler.
Oh, okay.
But was middle distance sprinter and a rower.
What events did you run?
I was a 400 meter
guy. Okay.
Yeah, which is a terrible thing to do with one's life.
How did you end up doing that?
Okay, funny. Randomly, right? I had not been a sports guy in junior high at some point in high school, just out of sort of boredom. Because rec sports sort of go away. You know, when you get to high school, you can't just sort of play Little League baseball or whatever. I went to the track team. Like, I could just do this, right? Because I don't have any skill sports skills to play at the high school level. So went out for the track meet where you would just run in like the fifth heat with like the other freshmen, and was slow. And it was like, okay, this is sort of stupid. And I don't remember the exact details, but it was definitely one of those classic stories where it was at a meet. It was my sophomore year, maybe at this point, and the lead 400 meter runner got injured. And there was like, the other one wasn't there. And it was just like, all right, Cal, you're left. So we just need you to run like in the first heat of the 400. And I was like, well, I'm just going to open it up and drop like 6 or 7 seconds off my time. One of those situations. And like, okay, well, now you're our one 400 meter runner. And so I became a middle distance sprinter sort of by accident.
Wow. And then you rode in college for a while until you had a heart condition, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. So I go to college and it turns out like tall, skinny, middle distance sprinters is exactly what you need for lightweight rowing, right? Because I was like 6'2", like a 165 with sprinter muscles, like in the legs, but upper body, like whatever. It was just, they found me in a crowd. It was like, you need to come like get on an erg. And I pulled a good number and I was like a pretty good rower. I was on the freshman team, but, you know, this is an Ivy League school. They recruit for rowing.
To be Dartmouth. Is that right?
Dartmouth. Yeah. And so it was like 4 or 5 recruits. And then there's like a couple of us walk-ons. Like, I actually loved that. I loved rowing. My theory going into Dartmouth, cause I just came out of a public school in New Jersey, was I want to do like the most sort of ridiculous Eastern elite Ivy League things I can, like if I'm here. So I was like an art history minor just because it felt really like this is what you should do at an old school. And rowing just felt like the most Eastern elite. I had no idea what this sport was. It's like, this is great. This is like the craziest thing. To me, it was all so novel. I loved it. It was great. And then I got that heart condition. It was an atrial flutter, which is a tachycardia, exercise induced, just, you know, 200 plus beat per minute heart rate would just could hit you whenever. And saw some specialists, like you got to take these beta blockers to control your electricity in your heart. And it reduced my max heart rate by like 20%. That's what beta blockers do. And that is so measurable when you're in a sport like rowing, where you can see like, here's my average watt per stroke. Right. And it was just exactly commiserate. Everything went down by 20%. And it was like, it was just too frustrating. I fell out of the first boat. I just couldn't do the sport as well as I could before. I was taking a pill that was making me worse at the sport. And I was like, oh, this is too frustrating. And so that was that. But it worked out well because I said, what am I going to do instead? And I said, why not writing? So it was really like me saying, how am I going to fill my time now that I'm not, you know, rowing? It was the decision I made was, well, let me try writing as a thing I'm going to spend time on. And so it was my sophomore fall that I launched this experiment where I got very systematic about studying and I was experimenting. It wasn't even just, I'm going to be really organized. It was, I'm going to experiment in an organized way. What's the right way to take notes? What's the right way to memorize art history dates? What's the right way to do problem sets? And I launched these experiments. I was very rigid about, okay, how do I do schoolwork right? And it was like a huge success. Just my grades, 4 O's. It was like 4 O's all the way out from there, except for like 1 A- in my senior year. So, you know, it's a good question because I don't know if I attributed that to rowing before. But maybe it was. I was like, look, I can't just get rid of all discipline from my life. But what's left? Well, I'm just a student now. Okay, great. Let me move that discipline over to being a student. And it was like a huge win.
And how did you find those techniques, like the study techniques?
It's not that hard. See, here's the thing about being a student. It's kind of an easy job. It's a job that we give to morons. And by morons, I don't mean in intellectually. I just mean from a maturity standpoint. If you're at a 4-year college, it's a lot of 19-year-olds, right? So they're like, I don't know, this is great. Like, I can drink large quantities of beer and do crazy things to get girls to look at me. You know, it's just not the way they're thinking, right? But if you give it even just a little bit of systematic thought, does this make sense? Like, this is how I'm studying for whatever. Just give like a little bit of systematic thought. It's pretty obvious, like, oh, this would be better. Let me try this. I was sort of used to, for example, business advice books and business advice literature. So I had a little bit of that pragmatic nonfiction background in my blood. So that probably helped guide me, but it wasn't that hard. I mean, nothing I discovered was that hard. It was basically, don't read stuff passively. Don't read over your notes. You have to like actively review things and plan out when you're going to do your work so it's not all the night before. Like, that's 80%. Of getting straight A's is right there. It's like using a calendar and throwing out your highlighter. Like, those two things are going to get you like to the dean's list for sure.
And when did you start the Study Hacks blog? That was the first thing you did, right? Was that 2007? When was that?
Yeah, that was right after my second book came out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, because I wrote, this was my marketing brilliance. Right. So my first book came out 2005 and my second book 2006. I sort of wrote those back to back, right?
When did you graduate college?
2004.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah. So I wrote the first book I signed with Brad and I's mutual agent, Lori, shout out. I signed with her right before I turned 21. It was like at the end of my junior spring. And we sold How to Win at College that summer before my senior year. And I wrote that in the fall of my senior year. Then in the spring of my senior year, I sold right away this next book. And then I wrote that over that summer and into the fall of my first year at graduate school. And that came out the next year. So those books came out one after another. And that's when I realized, you have to, like, people need to know you have books out, that just, they don't just go out into the world and people find them and buy them. And so I started Study Hacks. The entire point was, at first, here's the stuff that didn't make it into my second book. Right? The second book was How to Become a Straight A Student. And I was like, I'll just have a blog where I can just keep talking about this. Like, here's ideas that didn't make it into the book. And my thought was, that'll be a way to find people. And then I can sort of bring more people into the book. So that was 2007. So it was book in 2005, book in 2006, Study Hacks blog 2007.
What's neat about that timeline is we'll get to your more current work soon, but Slow Productivity, your most recent book, is quite good and just absolutely, from where we sit, crushing it. People are reading it. People are loving it. The marketing has gone well. People know about it. And we often say, like, the secret to greatness is, like, find something you're good at and do it for a decade or two. And it's, like, right at the 2-decade mark. That, like, what might appear to be more of, like, an overnight success is, like, anything but that.
Mm. I mean, I always used the 1-decade mark as being really important for me, because when I was coming out of college, I had these sort of two goals. Like, I wanted to be a professor. Like, I wanted to be an academic. And I wanted to be a serious writer, which to me meant an idea book in hardcover. Right. And so I couldn't do that right out of school. Right. I mean, the only books I could sell was it's paperback original written by a student, you know, for students. Both those things came true a decade after I got started. So right around the time I turned 30, my first hardcover idea book came out and I got hired in my first academic job, my first professorship job. All of my 20s were spent working on that. So my books in my 20s, I have these three paperbacks in a row that are all aimed at students. But they're also incredibly intentionally engineered. Each one, it was a harder writing challenge than the last on purpose, right? So the very first book, because I was young, I was 21, I purposely designed it to be easy to write. It was 75 rules. I was good at coming up with rules, like contrarian titles. But each rule is like 2 pages. There wasn't chapters. It was just, here's a bunch of ideas. My second book, I very purposely said, okay, now I want just a standard chapter format. Then my third book, man, I really got crazy with that third book. So my third book was, I need to take off all the training wheels and write a straight up idea book. I want to write it Malcolm Gladwell style. And so that third book, which is ostensibly a book about college admissions, I wrote straight up like a Malcolm Gladwell, Steven Johnson mashup idea book. It was all training, right? Like, I knew that book was not going to sell a ton of copies on its own, but it was my final step of training before I was ready for, you know, when I turned 30 to publish my first actual contrarian hardcover advice book. So I spent a decade working on my writing just to get to kind of what I thought to be the starting line.
Wow. That's so intentional. My question off that is how balanced were you in your 20s, or were you just working all the time? Because this is something we discuss a lot on the show, is like how to weigh grand ambition with having a robust enough life around that grand ambition that it can support it. But, you know, there's always the thing of like, what's the cost of being great and achieving everything you want? So I'm curious how, when you were laser focused in on your 20s, you're obviously still very laser focused, but I'm curious, like, if you felt like if you look back at that time and you're like, I made a ton of sacrifices and I was really working my ass off, or how you think about that.
I wasn't in my 20s because my day job was being a grad student, which isn't really a job, especially... I'll be clear about it. There's a lot of grad student positions that are very time consuming. Like, if you're working in a lab and you have to put in long hours, but I was a theoretician. So to be a theoretician grad student, it's just go solve some theorems and write some papers this year. And you can only think so much about theory. And so it just wasn't that much work. And so I just used writing to sort of balance out the theory, because when that wasn't going well, because it's hard and I'm not, you know, I have some horsepower, but I'm not like the really good theoreticians. When that was going bad, I could put my attention on the writing, be like, well, at least I have this. And then when the writing was stalled, I could put my attention on the mathematics. But I did make a specific point to do that, right? Because when I was leaving college, my choice for my primary job was grad school, and I had an offer from Microsoft. It's like Microsoft was the big tech company back then in the sort of early 2000s. And I remember very specifically making the choice, if I go to Microsoft, I'll get money, but it would be really hard to write books at the same time. Like I would really have to be sort of like laser focused, crushing it, like working late at night or whatever. And I just didn't think I had that in me. I didn't really want to do that. And so I very specifically chose grad school, in which they pay you very little money. I think the stipend for a research assistantship back then at MIT was like $26,000 a year or something, right? I was giving up all that, but I knew I would have a lot of flexibility with my time and I could write and become a better writer. And it would be very rare that I would be sort of overworked or really busy. And so that was the gamble I made. I was like, I'm going to fill in my income with like writer advances and live cheap. And that actually ended up working out well. So I was not stressed in my 20s at all.
Hmm. And in terms of productivity tools, I want to get into some tools so we can give the listeners things that they can use, but I'm curious what has stood the test of time. I mean, you're writing books about how to win at college, how to be a grade A student. You're also in your own life. It sounds like being, you know, writing your doctoral dissertation. You're also writing books. What are some of the techniques you developed back then that you still use today? Or even if you don't use, you're like, I was spot on that. That was a great and effective strategy.
I mean, if you go back to how to become a straight A student, right, this is 2006 and it has a bunch of time management advice in it. So like we can go back and kind of check the transcript, right? Okay, so what specifically did I say there that I would still do today? There's a couple ideas in there that I still swear by today. One was autopilot scheduling was definitely in there. So like, hey, if you know something's going to happen regularly, make a regular time for it. So in the context of that book, it was, I know I have a problem set due every week. So when am I going to work on the problem set? Let's not make that something I have to figure out every week. Let's just fix the time. This is when and where I do that work. I also had in that book, I was really big on planning out work in advance. And the way I talked about it in the book was figure out when all of your midterms were, your papers were due, and then work backwards and figure out when am I going to do the work for this? Like allocate the time in advance. And also that book had a sort of rudimentary time block planning as well. Like don't just go through your day and like, I don't know, what do I want to get done today? Like look at your day and say, when am I going to do work? That was in there as well. So I think that real intentionality about you have this time as a resource, be very careful about it. And be expansive about it. I'm going to start this 3 weeks early. Let me do an hour here, an hour there. When am I going to do this work? When are things going to get done? So this sort of visualizing time as a tangible resource with weight and substance. And I have this much of it and I have this much things to do. And how am I going to move this around and shape into the things that need to get done? That is definitely something to carry through. In grad school, I then developed another idea that stuck with me ever since, which was fixed schedule productivity. So in grad school, I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to fix my working hours and I'm not going to work outside of those working hours. So I have to figure out how to make that function. And whatever I have to do, whatever I have to invent in terms of systems, whatever I have to do with my scheduling, whatever I have to do with just my workload, these are my work hours. And I'm going to work backwards just to make everything fit into there. Now that was easy to do as a grad student, but I stuck with that even as I left grad school, went into postdoc, and then when I went into my academic jobs. I've always stuck with that ever since. Work backwards from the hours. If your work is not easily fitting to those hours, then this is a forcing function to change something.
It's such a powerful forcing function. So in healthcare, when healthcare costs are like up the wazoo, this is going back to a past life when I thought about this all the time. For the longest time, we tried to make healthcare more efficient. And the only thing that has ever been proven to cut healthcare costs is what's called capitation, when you simply say we're not spending more than X dollars, and then everything else falls into place. And I can't tell you how many people I've worked with who have tried to like efficiency their way into more time with their family or whatever it is. And the only thing that ever works is eventually being like, I'm just going to be done at 6 p.m. every day. And if everything falls through the cracks and I get fired from my job, so be it. And nothing falls through the cracks. They don't get fired from their job. And like suddenly everything falls into place.
That's fascinating. So people do it with fear, like your clients, and then they're fine because the work expands.
That's it. the work expands to fill the time that you give it. And if you capitate it, or to use your words, like fixed productivity scheduling, then it just has a forcing mechanism of what's actually important versus what's not. I mean, kids do this to some extent too, assuming that you're involved with your kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm a big believer in that. And I think it's more urgent now than it used to be because, especially with digital technology, it's much easier to expand the work footprint as well, right? So if it's really just like, I'm going to work until I get a lot of things done today, what you end up doing is basically negotiating with yourself at every minute. Like, well, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? And the voice that says, well, why don't we do email right now? Or why don't we check in on Slack? Like, that voice is going to win a lot because it has a good argument. If you don't have a plan for your day, its argument is, you know, we're going to have to check this again at some point. So why not right now? And if you're just sort of free flowing your day, you're like, I guess right now. And then you end up just so much of your time gets just diverted into this sort of low intensity context switching. Let me just jump on the easiest, shallowest things. Yeah. So when it's just, let's just work hard and try to get enough stuff done that we feel good, that type of vagueness doesn't really cut it anymore.
And how do you do that now? I'm curious. I want to like pull on this a little bit from your own life, because from the outside looking in, you are writing these great books. You're in the zeitgeist. So you're doing tons of podcasts, radio shows. You are a professor at an illustrious school at Georgetown, and you've got three young kids. I mean, I know your family, you're involved in their life. So I'm curious, like, what does Cal Newport currently do to hold it together and essentially like not lose your mind? Because what happens is so many people in our field, it's like such an occupational hazard, is you start to get some success and then you lose your mind. Like, you become a guru, you become a know-it-all, you go all in on that thing to the exclusion of all else. You go on Twitter, which you've avoided, but you haven't done that. And I think people underestimate how hard it is not to do that. So on the podcast, we often talk about like our own tools for not doing that, but curious to hear yours.
Well, I mean, partially I sequence things, right? I mean, there's this collapse effect. I think of it as like accomplishment collapse, which really distorts the reality of how people get things done. It's like you listed three or four things there that, you know, that I've done. It's easy when someone hears that to collapse all those things into the same time period and imagine like, okay, so how at once do you do all these different things, right? Because when we hear a list of things, we collapse it all into one time period, but I sequence things. Like, I'm on a book tour mode right now, which means I'm doing a lot of podcasts. All right. So I'm not doing other things. I'm not writing a book right now. I'm not working on difficult academic projects or articles right now. I arranged things very carefully with the New Yorker, where I really wrote a lot in the fall so that I could slow down with that writing in the spring as I'm doing, you know, the book tour. Then the summer is going to be different. When I shut down my book tours, I shut down my book tours. I don't do a lot of podcasts, et cetera, when I'm not actually actively promoting something. So that'll all shut down. I'll disappear for the summer, start thinking, probably work on writing over the summer. And so everything has its season. So the things, they go one after another. There'll be a period where I'm really working on a book. There'll be a period where I'm really working on an academic project. There'll be a period where I'm promoting a book, but they're not all at the same time. Mm. No. And fixed schedule productivity forces that to be the case. Like, I can't right now be trying to do another hard project while I'm doing the promotion, because I'm not going to be able to get that to fit. It's not going to fit in the 9 to 5:30. So it's a forcing function that forces me to, okay, I have to put that aside right now. Move it over here. It just comes through in the slow productivity book when I get into all the slowing down terminology about timelines. This is kind of what it looks like, is it'll be fine. Like, I can write the book later. Like, the book will be written. There'll be other books written. Like, who can tell the difference if I do it 6 months earlier or not? Like, no one's keeping track of that. They'll one day look back and say, you wrote a bunch of books and here's three I liked, you know? And so, like, if you're one right after another, or stacking a book writing on top of a publicity tour because it's going to keep your publisher happy that you turned it around fast, like, no one in the end is going to care about that, but you're going to feel the negative brunt of that.
I want to hang on this point because I think it's so important, and I think it's one of the sort of sources of disagreement in your work, and it's something I agree with you on, but I find it hard to impress upon other people. Which is, like, slow productivity, one of your precepts in there is do fewer things. And I'm thinking of what Brad just said in terms of captation and like c- cutting work off at 6 p.m. and saying, I'm going to let things fall through the cracks, and then things don't fall through the cracks and you survive. I think that's so true. I think if people did less and just set hard boundaries, and now granted, some people can't do this, right? If you're a first year at an iBanking job, like you're kind of screwed, right? But for a lot of people who do have, who even people who aren't fully autonomous, who report up, but have some autonomy and can set harder limits, they feel like these days they're so overwhelmed that it's really hard to convince them. You just need to let things fall through the cracks and live with the anxiety, what that feels like for like a month. And if you do that upfront, you're going to see it work on the back end on a longer time trajectory. But I think that point is so hard to convince people of. And when I've discussed your books with friends, because I'm kind of a true believer in your books, this is the thing they say. They're like, I just can't do it. Like, I can't stop work at 6 p.m. I can't do less. And so I just want to, like, it's not necessarily a question, but I'm curious what that brings up for you, because I think this is the point where people are like, either go or like, yes, I'm in, I agree with you, Cal, or they're like, I can't do that. And I'm curious how you make that case to somebody who falls into the camp of like, I'm not going to be able to put strict limits on when I can stop.
Well, I mean, one of the things I say to them is don't think about it like strict limits, right? I mean, strict limits when you stop, sure. But like the issue that people often have is I can't put limits on how much work I take on, right? Like the strict limits, people are happy to have strict limits on their time to work if they feel like it'll be possible to actually make the work fit into there, right? Their problem is like, I couldn't even imagine coming close to being able to finish at 5 or being able to finish at 6, right? So the real problem is, why is that the case? And typically the reason why that's the case is that there's too many concurrent commitments that are active at the same time, right? They have too many things that they're actively working on at the same time. Each of those things generates administrative overhead. If you have too many things generating administrative overhead, emails and meetings, et cetera, it clogs up your day like a logjam, right? And like nothing gets down to river. It's like, now, of course I can't finish, because I've just been doing email and meetings, just keeping up with this administrative overhead for 10 ongoing active projects all day. But the stuff still has to get done. In fact, when does the stuff get done then? Well, it's kind of going to get done after hours, because that's when the administrative overhead doesn't happen. And so if you're in that situation, nothing could seem more impossible than just saying, stop working at 5. Because that would mean for a lot of people, basically don't finish anything ever again, right? Like it really would be a disaster if they did that. So the solution then is to do fewer things. Now, of course, this is really scary, because now what people imagine is having some sort of cinematic confrontation with their boss. You know, it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, and let me tell you why. And then they get real anxious about imagining that conversation and like, oh my God, this is not going to work. I'm going to get fired. But doing fewer things doesn't have to mean that, because like what it really means is do fewer things, have fewer active commitments at the same time. And so I've been talking a lot in this tour. I've been trying to sort of explain to people, even just splitting the stuff you've agreed to do into two categories, actively working on, waiting to work on. And like, as I finish something I'm actively working on, I bring in the next thing from this list of things I've agreed to work on. Even that change, which doesn't require you to say no, it just means you maintain a different status for the things I'm actively working on and the stuff I'm waiting to work on. Even that little change is an exponential difference, because now you have two or three things generate administrative overhead. That's it. So you can actually do things during the day and the stuff starts getting done and you're pulling stuff into the active category pretty quickly. And now your rate at which things are actually leaving this system done is higher than it's ever been before. Now stopping work at 5:30, like, yeah, of course. Like I'm moving through things really quickly. So, I mean, I think this idea of this logjam idea is a big one.
So I want to ask a follow-up question here. The administrative overhead topic was probably my favorite part of the book. It's what we wrote about in the newsletter a couple months ago when the book first came out. And for those that haven't read the newsletter, one, you should subscribe. But two, administrative overhead, simply how I interpret it, is that when we take on really big projects or even small projects, whether they're super exciting or not, they come with these other activities that are layered on top of them. So if you want to write a book, that sounds great, but then you got to have meetings with your publisher. If you want to start a podcast, that sounds great, but then you have to have an editorial calendar and pay someone to edit it if you want it to be any good, and so on and so forth. And when we choose projects, we often discount or we don't think about the administrative overhead. So when you are selecting what projects to do, you want to keep in mind how much administrative overhead will it add. And I wrote what I thought was a really good piece drawing on that topic. And the feedback that we got was completely bifurcated. Entrepreneurs, creators, people who control their own schedule, writers, photographers, chefs said, this is great. This is so helpful. Thank you. People that report up to managers in big organizations said, my boss tells me I have to do these six projects. What should I do? Yeah. So how would you, and I didn't know what to say. I said, I'll ask Cal when we have him on the podcast. So here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are the two audiences, right? Like these are definitely the two audiences. It's the entrepreneurs and the people who actually work for other people in an office. All right. So when it comes to your boss, here's the way I've been thinking about this. The problem you're solving for your boss is making stress go away. Right. So what happens when a boss gives you something to do? What's the actual chain of events here? This, whatever this thing is, comes into their life. Now it's a source of stress, right? This thing needs to get done. I have to make sure this thing gets done. It's my responsibility. Your job, like what you're doing for the boss, is you take that stress away. If you do that thing, they no longer have to be stressed about this thing going on. If they don't know anything about your workload or how you work, if there's no transparency into like your organizational systems, they're going to want you to do this right away, right? Because otherwise, as far as they're concerned, or maybe I told Brad to do this, but I'm still keeping track of this because I don't know if he's going to remember to do this. I don't know how he organizes his work. So I'm just going to have to stay on until he gets him done because I want the stress to go away. And so I would rather you do it right now because until you do, I'm still keeping track of this. If you have a transparent system that they trust, right? Here is how I keep track of my work. Like the specific thing I recommend in the book is like you have like a shared document they can look at. They can see exactly where the project is, exactly its status, watch it move towards your active projects list. They learn through experience that as soon as it hits your active list, you're going to immediately contact them. I'm now actively working on this. Email me anytime about this. Here, you know, let's have a meeting. Let's get into it. I'm going to get this done. I'm going to get it done now. It's getting my full attention. I'm going to do this well. Once they know this is how you operate in this thought experiment, once you put your task, this thing on their list, you've solved their problem. I don't have to worry about this because I trust Brad. I see how this, I know how his system works. He moves things through here fast. He'll let me know when it's time to talk about it. And you've solved their problem. They're going to be okay with that. You'd be surprised by how often that's going to work. Because I think something knowledge workers forget is they do have a lot of autonomy. This is what makes knowledge work very different than other types of sectors. In terms of how you organize your work, how you organize your labor, how you manage your time, how you figure out what to work on next, all of that is left up to the individual in knowledge work. You have a huge amount of autonomy. I can't do this in a Ford plant. I can't say, no, I don't like this whole assembly line the way you have it set up. I kind of do things my way and I want to put the steering wheel on and not the wheel. And you know, it doesn't work that way. In knowledge work, you have a huge amount of autonomy in terms of how you structure and organize your labor.
Yeah, so let me ask you this question pointedly, because I think one of the things that gets said is like, you are very busy. Like you seem like someone who's doing a lot of things, telling people to do less things. But is it actually that you're doing less things? You're just in this sort of sequencing, you're getting a lot done.
I do sequence a lot. Yeah, like we talked about before, the nature of my job. Now, I always say my job is very idiosyncratic, right? Right. So looking specifically at the structure of my job and saying your job should be like that, it doesn't make sense if you're not a professor writer, right?
Yeah.
But no, these principles are really core to me. I when administrative overhead begins to pile up too much, I get a sort of immune reaction. So we got to start simplifying, constantly simplifying, constantly worried about if there's too many things actively happening right now, this is going to be a problem, right? And so in part, the book is a prescription for myself, but in part, I believe strongly in those principles. You know, I feel physically uncomfortable when I have too much going on. I do not like crowded schedules. I do not like having breathing room and flexibility. I want to work on hard things over time. I really don't like busyness. And so I try the best I can to live through these.
You've also built up capacity. I mean, you've been doing this for 20 years. So it's akin to going to the weight room and saying, you know, y'all should be able to deadlift 600 pounds like me. And it's like, not if you're brand new to deadlifting. It's going to take you some time to build up work capacity to be able to handle that kind of load. So I think there's maybe some discounting too. And it's probably not the best thing to tell a journalist is, well, I've been doing this for 20 years and I've got a lot of natural talent. But I think both those things are probably true at the same time, what I'm hearing that I also in my own life find like very helpful is there's a difference between having 10 things that you are juggling at once and having 10 things that you are going to do sequentially over a year.
Yes.
And the latter is so much more easeful.
Yep.
And you can get so much more done that way. And as a writer, where I sometimes fall into a problem, and this is a difference between me and you, because I am on the social media platforms. I'm on Instagram and I'm on Twitter. And what's become the bane of my existence is feeling like, oh, I got to like put some new content out. And that's kind of like a ball that I'm always having to juggle. So yeah. Even when I'm like in deep monk book writing mode, I can be pretty good about like, all right, I'm not going to phone it in on the newsletter, but it's not going to be my best work. I'm going to lean on Steve and Clay to do more of that. I'm not going to be pitching anything to the New York Times because that's just not the priority right now. My coaching clients, I'm going to push all coaching to one day a week so I can really take Monday to Thursday to just write. But just having in the back of my mind, like, am I putting something out on the internet? Just fucks with me versus when I just schedule that stuff or I'm just like, screw it. I'm not going to post on Instagram this week and it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And it's literally like the actual act of posting on Instagram takes 8 minutes, but it's the mental load of like having that thing that causes the stress.
Well, because there's going to be potential reaction to it, right? I mean, you're really tapping something primal, which is I just gave a speech to the tribe. Right. I came in the front of the cave and gave a speech to the tribe. It's possible if that speech didn't go well, someone's going to throw a spear at my head. Right. Like, so our brain like really cares. Right. It's, so it's not so simple as just I posted something. How, what was the mechanical act of doing that? Well, it didn't take me long to write it. And I just press, you know, send. I don't know what the Instagram button is, but whatever you press. But the reality is now my mind is like, what's going on? What are people saying? I mean, this was the original, by the way, this was like, not to get back into tech theory, but just like my true love. I mean, this was the accident that started the entire social media revolution, right? Social media, as we know it, as a tool that we look at all the time, the accident that caused that is when Facebook added the like button. Right? Because they had this whole model before that the point of Facebook is you post stuff about what's going on, and then you go look at your friends' pages and you comment on their wall. And it's like, hey, Brad, good. You know, I'm glad you got a new PR and you're lifting or whatever. It was like a way for friends to comment on each other's life. It was like, we can give attention to each other, right? And check on the relationship status of people like our college roommates or whatever. Like, that's what it was about, right? And then they added the like button. And the like button was added originally for a very pragmatic reason. It was supposed to be a way to aggregate simple comments. So instead of saying congrats, exclamation point, you could just hit like, and then it would leave the comment section for like longer comments. Like, that was the idea behind the like button. Is the engineers thought it was suboptimal that if you announced something cool that happened, that you had 50 comments from your friends all saying great. Like, no, just press like for that, right? But then the engagement number shot up. Because now suddenly, like after I posted something, I could get feedback from other human beings on like, did they see it? Did they like that? Did they not like that? And so the engagement numbers on mobile shot up once they added the like button, because there's this new behavior that didn't exist before, which was, I'm just going to kind of keep checking this throughout the day.
And yeah, like, you're day trading on your identity, which is like a really precarious, addictive place to be. I want to zoom way out for a second. So rewind maybe 10 years, just about 10 years. It's the time that you write Deep Work in the General Neighborhood. It's when we put out Peak Performance, and there is like such a focus on productivity and performance. And we are on the top of the mountain. We're a little bit like ahead of the rest of the zeitgeist. And this is like a really wonderful celebrated thing. And then I'm painting in broad strokes, but the bros come in. And they take these terms and they take these ideas and they start parroting a whole bunch of nonsense that drives everyone, myself included, crazy. And there's this backlash. And then anything related to performance is just like a bunch of bros jumping in a cold plunge. And anything related to productivity is you just want to optimize your whole life and you're like a robot. You're not even a real person. And out of that came what I'm going to call like the anti-performance or the anti-ambition or the anti-work movement. We've talked about the hypocrisy that so many of the anti-work writers put out newsletters with 10,000 words every day. So they're clearly working pretty hard on anti-work, but it became like a thing. And I'm curious, like, is the pendulum swinging back, and where do you see yourself in your work right now? And how do we make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and kind of rightfully call bullshit on the people that are parroting these topics without any nuance, without releasing from these topics altogether, which is like, thoughtful productivity is really important to living a good, meaningful life and just getting shit done, which we all have to do.
Yeah. Here's one thing I've always noticed. I think the online world and the book world have been, they're very different. And actually, I'm going to like go back and edit the painting that you painted, because I don't think it was the case in 2016, 2017, that what was going on in the writing world was talking about how to do optimization, doing better, being more productive. I mean, our titles might have looked that way, but think about it, like peak performance, like what's one of the big ideas in there is about you're not recovering enough, right? It was like, athletes know the cycle of how you get better at things is you push and you recover and don't just be busy all the time, right? Look at the sequence of bestsellers that Deep Work was one of. It was Deep Work. The year before that was Essentialism. The year before that was Gary Keller, One Thing. Those are all books about doing fewer things, right? There's this idea out there that the anti-ambition people have that, oh, there's all these books that are being written about how to optimize yourself, how to do more things. And in fact, the anti-ambition people often will say, they will set themselves up as heroically fighting this straw man. Unlike everything else, I am saying, you shouldn't just try to do as much as possible or optimize your life. But I went back and looked at this, and what I think has happened, if you looked at the book industry, there was a major change in the early 2000s where we shifted strongly away from optimistic self-help or productivity built around how do I like accomplish my goals, right? We had that in the 80s. We had that in the 90s. We had Stephen Covey writing these books about self-actualize. If you build just the right plan, you can self-actualize all of your deepest values. You get to the 2000s, the first big book in the genre is Getting Things Done. And the anti-ambition people look at that title and think it's a book about optimization and doing more things. And it's not. It is a dark nihilistic book where David Allen is like, we're drowning in work, we're overloaded, and all I'm trying to do is find little moments of zen-like peace. It's very nihilistic. He's like, well, let's transform ourselves into these sort of, we're almost disconnected from our work robots. We'll just break everything down into pieces and just crank widgets all day so at least we can have some peace from the stress of having too much to do. And like from that point on, most of the big books in the business space were do fewer things. How do we get away from overload? How do we focus on just what matters? So I don't think books were there, but the online world did go there. And I think a lot of the people in the anti-ambition, anti-work movement are very online. So those two things got mixed together. For me, it's always confusing because I'm not really online because I don't use social media. So I don't know that online world very well. So in my mind, I'm like, yeah, people writing about this, it's like Brad and you know, Greg McEwen, and you know, we should do fewer things and we're trying to like focus on what matters. But I think a lot of other people's impression of this world is, you know, taking the right neuropeptides so that you can focus longer when you work on. So I think the online book split was the problem. And books are, there's a lot of gatekeepers and they're hard to write. And the people who write them, we tend to be pretty considerate. Online, you know, it's whatever. I'm fighting the algorithm. I want attention. And I think that just went to nonsense land. So I don't, do you buy this, Brad? But it seems to me like there's this huge divide print, non-print when it comes to like what we mean by like productivity or business advice.
I think so. That's a really good point. And I take your edit on how I painted that picture. And I think that gets back to just the mechanics of the internet and in particular social media, which is when you're writing for social media, especially if you're doing it strategically to try to grow a platform or an audience, you want to find something that is a little bit provocative and controversial and it's going to hit in the moment and the feedback is right away. Yeah. When you're writing a book, it's not going to come out for 12 months after you send it to your editor. There's no immediate feedback. So you have no incentive to try to like hit the zeitgeist. Your incentive is to write a good book and to write what you know to be true. So I think that that's right. I think that another way to think of it is so much of what we read on the internet is like the synthetic version of like the actual good stuff. Yeah. But you can get addicted to the synthetic version and then people get really pissed off because they're sick of seeing the synthetic version.
Do you feel like, I feel like this is something Brad and I were talking about, but I haven't read your earliest books, but the Slow Productivity book very much feels to me like a method of productivity that is meant to get you to a good life. Like, it's not being productive for the sake of being productive. It's being productive so that you can get on living your life. I don't know if your early books were like that, or like, I imagine they were more just about getting things done to get things done. Is that, was there a shift in your work, and how do you explain that if there was?
Yeah, there's a huge shift actually. So my first two books were just like how to do well in college. Right. And it was very nuts and bolts. Like, here's the right way to study, like do this, don't do this. I was like, this is great. The only issue out there is people are not efficient and their study habits are bad. I'll show them how to have good study habits and they'll be like, this is great. I'm getting good grades and I have like a lot of extra time. And it was this huge eye opener because it was the first time I was really encountering the fact that a lot of students were dealing with like a lot of stress. And there was a lot of psychological things going on. There's at these elite schools in particular, there were students that they felt like the weight of the expectations of their whole hometown was on their shoulders. And they had to like live up to the expectation. I got into MIT and I've got to live up to it. And they're overloading themselves and crazy workloads and all these activities. And they were under all of this stress. And I couldn't solve their problems by just saying study better. Because they would have three majors, or they would have 10 different major activities, and they would just completely burn themselves out. And I would sit down and show them on their calendar, this doesn't fit. Like, you got to do a lot fewer things. Like, what are you doing here? And they couldn't. They're like, no, I have to keep doing all these things. And it became this big shift in my writing. If you look at my Study Hacks blog, like a year into it, it shifts hard away from here's how to study for this type of test and into how do you fight stress and overload as a college student. So, you know, by the time I get to 2009 or 2010, I'm completely oriented to the sustainability and psychological reality of people and their work. And that's why that theme goes through so much of my work of how do you make this sustainable? How do you make this something that you enjoy doing? How do you do things you're proud of without burning out? I just really grew a distaste for overload and busyness.
All right. So fast forward to this most recent book, which I loved. I know Clay loves. Steve's not here. He loved it. If you all haven't read it or listened to it yet, you should absolutely do it. You'll find it valuable, entertaining. I mean, I don't know. We feel like the Growth Equation books and Cal's books ought to be on the same bookshelf. So if you're reading our stuff, you should read all of Cal's stuff. That is a preface for something that happens right when your book is coming out, which is it gets dinged in the New York Times book review. And we talk a lot on this podcast about how it's easy to be motivated and to be optimistic and positive when things are going well, but it's hard when things aren't. Now, I immediately called you because we're close friends. I thought that the review was quite unfair. I think that there was a lot of Cal's giving advice, and elite people shouldn't give advice. They should just talk about problems. But that's besides the point. I'm interested in, you've done all this work leading up to your book. You've got great pre-order numbers. You're trying to hit all the bestseller lists, which you end up doing. And then like this thing happens that's really shitty. How did you handle that?
Well, it definitely was deflating for a while. Because it was a change in the agreement I thought I had with my elite peers, and I had to adjust, right? I was like, oh, this is a new phase. Because I'd always, here's the agreement I had with my elite peers was that I code switch, right? So I'm an academic, I write academic work, I do sort of semi-academic work for the New Yorker and write sort of idea pieces for them. But also my entire adult life, I've written prescriptive nonfiction, where I give advice. And I really like that genre. And also I have this idea that smart people should write advice. Not all smart people should, but more smart people should give advice, because otherwise you cede that territory to the charlatans, right? And I think advice is like, I don't know, I love the genre. I grew up on the genre. I think it's a cool genre because it can directly affect change better than any other genre. Like you can get into someone's life and they can change the way their life unfolds if you're just specific. So I love the genre, but the agreement I had with my elite colleagues was, I know you guys don't like this stuff, and that's fine. And I know you might sort of look down on me a little bit for doing it, and that's fine. But I'm okay with that because I always used to say, I don't need my like books to prove to people that I'm smart because like I'm also a professor and have a doctorate from MIT. So I'm okay not getting your praise. And I thought that was the agreement. This was the first time though, they actually moved past just, we're not going to give you our praise because we're the New York Times. We don't review advice books. And it shifted to, we're going to give you negative feedback. So I thought the agreement was like, yeah, of course, like I'm not going to be reviewed in the New York Times for these books because they're advice books. And that's fine. I don't need that validation. But I wasn't ready for the New York Times saying, no, no, we're going to actually dump on your book as opposed to just ignore it. And that was definitely a shift because they don't review these types of books.
How did you work through it is what I'm curious about, because it's kind of akin to like an athlete, you know, playing in the championship game and like two or three days before a presser, like someone that you thought was maybe on your side is just like, not going to happen.
The hard part is that for me, typically the right way to work through anything like that is just to start working on the next thing. Mm-hmm. Right. But when you're in a book tour, you're not working on the next thing. So I think it probably lingered longer than it needed to, but then I just got back into my work eventually. So I'll tell you the way it affected me psychologically that I didn't expect. For like a couple weeks, I had it in my mind, because you project. This is why I imagine if I was on Twitter, I would just be miserable all the time. You project that this is how everyone's thinking. And I remember whatever, like the first event I did after that review, I think it was like Politics and Prose. In my mind, I was like, this is going to be pretty contentious. It's going to be like a lot of people that are like really dismissive of me and like think this is bad stuff. And of course it's not, it's a book event. It's my fans coming to hear me and they like me. That's why they're there. They're just asking normal questions or whatever. So I went through that for a little bit. I had to sort of convince myself, don't project this into like everyone you meet. People, A, they're not thinking about you. A, and B, if they are, it's nowhere past just like, oh, that's cool. You have a book out. How's it doing? That's great. I'm proud of you. And I need to move on with my life. So I think now I've adjusted to that new reality that it's not just I'm going to be ignored, but depending on the topic, there might be a target, which is common, by the way. I think that's just like, hey, welcome. Your numbers went up another 20%. This is the new level. But
I was just going to say, like, I know you're very driven by the work, but debuting then at like number two on the New York Times list was probably like a pretty nice, like, yeah, well, let's see what everyone else thinks about this book.
But how do you respond to that too? Like, how do you respond to the validation? Do you have a way of like not getting caught up in that either?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I guess like, you know, I have not had a New York Times bestselling book and I haven't been reviewed negatively by the New York Times. So I don't know either, but I could imagine that both of those are like pretty potentially big emotional swings. And you had that happen within the span of like 6 days.
Yeah. The New York Times thing is interesting. To me, that doesn't validate my book was going to be successful or not. The New York Times thing I see as just a function of audience size plus conversion strategy. Like Brad, we've talked about this before, but that's pretty formulaic. It's
The bestseller list.
Yeah. And so I was very happy to be on it because it meant that thing that I could control, which is, and I spent a lot of time after my last book, building my audience, cultivating it, building out a podcast. I brought on a consultancy just to help me pre-order campaign like for that audience. So it was like validating that worked. But that
just as an aside to the start of the podcast, you sound like such an athlete right now. Cause like what I'm hearing is like, I got the right coaching, I got the right program, I executed it, and I showed up and like the race went well. So I do think that your rowing is still in your blood.
But I don't even think that is the race went well. I think of that as like, oh, I qualified for a good lane, right? Because I was actually pretty terrified. The thing I'm terrified of, it's not terrified, but this is the thing authors fear, is the book disappears, right? And so I knew whether or not that book was going to be a book that is going to have legs or not, my audience would show up to pre-order and buy it, right? So I was like, good, I'm glad that worked. But I was terrified of week two. I was terrified. That was the thing I was really worried about, is like the week two number was going to be here. And then the week three number was just going to be down nowhere. Right. That was my fear. Cause I was like, what's the good having a big audience and converting them is great for like helping to spark some attention, you know, for your book, but then the book's got to have legs. So I was not, I did not see that as, oh, this book is going to crush it. So this whole, this other thing I'm worked up about is like what a launch should feel like. And I don't have a reference point. Like Digital Minimalism had a pretty good launch. I think that's my reference point. But my bar has become stupid there because basically what I've, and this is just, let's just give the psychological reality of writing to our listeners here. We're all friends. My bar, I realized, is I was anchoring on what are like the two biggest launches in our space of the year. And so basically what I'm saying is like, oh, I'm a little frustrated that I got 75% of the way to like the number one or number two launch of the year, but like wasn't the number one or number two launch of the year, but still is probably going to be like a highly ranked launch. That just becomes a stupid bar after a while. You know, it's like, why can't I be on the Amazon charts for 6 weeks instead of three? Or like, why can't I don't know. It's stupid stuff. It's weird.
Especially because I would come back to Deep Work and say like, Deep Work is the proof that none of that stuff matters. I mean, Deep Work has sold 1.5 million copies. You can rest on those laurels. And you were just saying like, it didn't do anything at its launch. Yeah. So maybe like that is the kind of ultimate like reference point that the launch just matters less than we think. What matters is like, you're proud of the work, you write a good book. And then if you're proud of it and you wrote a good book, you give yourself a shot to get lucky and to have it timed perfectly. Yep. But you can't really control that. And even for people that aren't listening as writers, I think like the big takeaway here is we all, myself included, get so focused on what is acutely in front of us and what we can measure if it is acutely in front of us. When like what we need to be doing is just focusing on creating a good body of work.
Yes.
And if you create a good body of work, you let the rest take care of itself.
Yeah, that's it. You can't force it.
That's it. It's so simple, but it's so hard to do when you're inundated with numbers and other people in publishing and peers who have books coming out and all of these other things.
Yeah. And can we make an analogy then to personalize it? We can make an analogy to social media, as I always do. Because think about like, what are you doing if you're on a lot of social media? Is you're bringing in those same sort of book launch dynamics to all these parts of your life. Like I'm caught up in book launch dynamics, which is, as you said, crazy. Like, okay, I want it to do well. But it doesn't really matter. I've already done the work. I wrote the book. It's going to work or not. And yet I'm like tracking and looking at this and how's it comparing to this person? And all that's meaningless. It's not going to help the book one bit that I'm paying attention to that. And so maybe we can expand that analogy too, where, you know, if you're spending a lot of time talking about your work as opposed to doing it, you're going to waste a lot of cycles.
Can I ask you another personal question? Yeah. As you get bigger and your work gets out there more, and you know, painting in broad strokes, like the elite colleagues, quote unquote, turn on you. And I don't think they'll ever turn all the way on you, but like, you know, it starts to go from they're ignoring you to like, they're poking at you. How do you think about not becoming a reactionary? Because you see this in so many people who started off as professors, and I'm not going to name names, in very like elite institutions and elite circles and did such good work. And then they start giving some advice. And then the kind of like elite world comes after them and they're rightfully pissed off. But then that goes to 2 years later, conspiracy theory thinking, the elites are all, you know, child trafficking, in everything that is ever published in the New York Times is, you know, part of a plot to come take away your freedom in America. And like, granted, I'm painting and obviously way too broad strokes, but there is this like reactionary swing where you're either like the pretentious book reviewers at an elite institution, or you're like, you know, part of the masculine brosphere.
Yeah.
And you're neither. How conscious are you of that? And then what do you have in mind to prevent that from happening? Because no one thinks they're going to become a reactionary.
Oh, I think it's pretty straightforward. Don't stop engaging in the institutions, right? So academics become reactionaries when they leave the institutions or effectively stop engaging in institutional life. That's when things can get a little bit dicey because academics in particular are very smart and have big egos. And when they lose the self-correction mechanism it doesn't mean something's going to go awry, but now you have the possibility, depending on what topics you're writing about, that if you're in the situation where people are turning on you, if you don't have the self-correction mechanism of I'm engaging in this institution with other academics who are correcting me and I'm correcting them, and we have this sort of collegiality, when you leave the institution, things can spiral out of control quick.
You mentioned that you're not on social media. You obviously spend a lot of time thinking about technology and its effects, its benefits, its harms. For someone who's maybe not familiar with your work, and it's a great oeuvre, I encourage them to read your books. In terms of thinking about like what I would call digital hygiene, or like how to engage with tech and social media, or even like Ezra Klein uses the phrase like attentional well-being, which I like how to focus your attention. What are the top things you'd tell someone to do, like with the starter pack of digital hygiene and attentional well-being?
That's an interesting question. Well, I mean, I would probably push a digital minimalist philosophy. And that philosophy, which is, you know, I wrote a book about it, is not minimizing, but about intention. So it's about working backwards from, let me actually just sit down and figure out, what do I want to do? What's important to me? What do I want to spend time doing? Mm-hmm. And then deploying technology tools were useful to support those things. And when you put the technology tool into your life, have some fences around it. So if you know I am using Facebook because really what I want is Facebook groups because my running group coordinates on there. If you know why you're using technology, it's easy to put fences around it. Oh, it doesn't have to be on my phone and I can have a newsfeed eradicator plugin. And so like I could just go right to the Facebook group. And then just be comfortable not doing the things that don't come up when you do that exercise. So it's like, here's what's important to me. Here's what I want to do with my time in work, outside of work, in family, like the different areas of your life. Here's where tech could help these things. And here's how I'm going to use tech to help those things. And that's the tech I'm using, right? And everything else I'll just miss out on. As opposed to having to go the other way of like, well, everything I'm going to sort of give a hearing until like it proves otherwise that I really shouldn't use it. No, it's like, it's not your job to be a beta tester for Silicon Valley attention platforms. Like your job is to try to craft the life you really like. There's places technology could really help that. Use technology in ways it really helps, and then just be really happy missing out on the rest. Like you don't need a tool to enter your life until there's something in your life that's really important to you and you have sort of evidence that this tool is really going to help that thing. And that mindset, it's a switch that flips from I'll use by default until I think it's bad to I won't use by default until I think it's good. That flip of a switch, I think, really changes your relationship with technology. And so that's digital minimalism. It's intention.
What's the most important part of your daily routine?
You know,
a few, like, or something that's non-negotiable.
Well, it's hard for me to talk about non-negotiables because I'm seasonal, right? So like different seasons of the year, my work is something different. Different times of my life is something different, right? So like right now I'm in book publicity mode. So things that would be super non-negotiable like this summer are completely negotiable right now, right? So it sort of depends on the season. For me, when I'm in like deep work modes, like in the summer or just maybe during the school semester, but I'm not publishing a book or something, that starting the day with that deep work first, like that's a non-negotiable. If I'm not getting concentrated time in, it's like, well, what am I doing? Because like ultimately this is my economic contribution to the world, all comes from my brain thinking about things and producing new things. Like that's what matters. That's the engine. That's what drives all of this. Everything else is just like packaging and marketing and the administrative overhead that surrounds it. And so when I'm not in book marketing mode, if I'm not getting in substantial concentration time every day, it's really distressing because it's, you know, it's the athlete who's not training. It's like, what's the point? You know, this other stuff is just going to, everything will crumble if I stop for any extended period of time, not trying to think really hard and create new information that has value. So that's a big non-negotiable. My shutdown routine's a big non-negotiable year round. When I'm done with work, I'm done with work. I have to close all the open loops. I have a checkbox in my planner, shutdown complete. Like that's a non-negotiable. I'm very stressed if I don't do that. I really do shut down work when I shut down. Like I don't, I'll get anxiety otherwise and it'll affect my sleep. So like that's a non-negotiable. When I'm done, I'm done. So during non-promotion times, deep work, and all year round, clear and actual shutdowns, work to non-work.
And then do you have like certain rituals of like when you, like how do you look at
your thing from a 60,000 foot view and figure out I have too much, I don't have enough, I have like my time is blocked appropriately, my time is I'm overstuffed. How do you figure all that out?
I do weekly planning and daily planning. You figure it out really soon. I'm feeling tight is what I always call it. My schedule's feeling tight. Like I don't have breathing room. There's too much going in here. There's too many things I'm not really looking forward to doing. And then I react and then I start to simplify. And one of the big ways I'll react is I'll go into the future and start blocking off time. It's like, if I feel like I'm getting tight, I'll start getting out of obligations, saying no to things, reversing commitments, obligations, and then blocking time in the future. And I call it protected on my calendar just to make sure that like pretty soon I'm going to get to a week where like Tuesday is completely empty. And so I react, but I can tell weekly planning is when I usually get my finger on it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm looking at my week. No, this is too tight. Like there's too much going on here. I'm in context switching mode. Like I'm most useful to the world when I'm spending a lot of time most days working on the same thing that's kind of hard and interesting. Like that's when I'm useful to the world. When I'm jumping around from all these different things for any extended period of time, it just feels wrong.
Mm. When you do deep work, I feel like people really struggle with deep work because it's just like the monotasking is hard. What about that is hardest for you?
I mean,
is it like, yeah.
Yeah, but like this is my sport.
Yeah. You
know? And like I've been on the all-star team for a while. Like it was
but
like
still, like even LeBron has to be like, sometimes I don't like stretching, you know?
First 15 minutes. It's no different than going for a hard run or a hard workout. It's like, right. You just got to find your rhythm. That's my experience with it. Sorry, I didn't mean to answer, Cal.
No, that's
it's your book.
Yeah, that is true. Right. First 15, but also what's going on in the first 15 minutes is cognitive context switching. It takes like 15 minutes for let's start inhibiting these unrelated networks and let's activate the networks related to what you're doing. It takes 15 minutes and then things start to flow. I don't know. I'm just used to it at this point. You know, I'll get my coffee. I have my locations I work in. It's hard for a while. Then it gets easier, but it's like you put in your time, you know, you got to put in your track time. It just, that's just, you have to have that mentality around it. It helps. I don't use social media. It helps like my phone's not interesting to me. Like there's nothing on it for me to look at, you know, there's not that many distractions to pull at me. So that helps. A lot of the stuff's just routine. It's like, this is what you do. You know, you do deep work a lot. Sometimes it goes better than others, but you get in your reps, you know, and like over time, your mile time goes down.
It's a great way to think of it.
I just read a book about the breaking of the 4 minute mile. So that's that's what I was
thinking. Nice. Steve will like that. Steve will like that we're ending on a running, bringing it back to running. Steve will feel very honored that he's not here, but we are paying tribute to his presence.
A big thanks again to Cal for joining us. Thanks to Brad for helping coordinate that interview and also coming on and adding some really useful thoughts and insights and questions. My big takeaways, I think, first is just the intentionality and consistency with which Cal has approached his career. I really like his concept of accomplishment collapse and how when we talk about someone who's successful, we make it seem like this all happened overnight. But Cal has been doing this for 2 decades. And so even though it seems like he might be doing a lot, he did a little bit consistently over time in sequences, and that led him to get here. So he was intentional and he was consistent and he did high quality work. And again, that just in everyone we talk to who is great at what they do, that seems to always be a through line. A few of his tools I really like. One was autopilot scheduling. So anytime you know you're going to have a repeated task, whether that could be homework in college or, for instance, this podcast comes out twice a week, I know what I have to do twice a week for this podcast. Just building that into your schedule and having a time every week you do it so you can kind of cut through the cognitive load of having to figure out when you're going to do that work every week. Also, fixed schedule productivity, meaning you have a certain amount of time you are working and you have to fit everything into that time. And it's a forcing function to make sure that you don't take on too much work or allow work to spill out of the cracks like gas and fill up all the available time. Then beyond that, I love his approach to technology and using these tools not by default, just because they're there and we should use them, but to use them intentionally and build them into your life to serve the things that you want to get done. So maybe not just adopting a new technology because it's new and shiny, but figuring out how can I actually use this in a way that helps me achieve my goals. And then lastly, his personal experience with the New York Times book review and saying that the best way to get over it was to just keep working and move on to the next thing. and try not to worry about the launch or the numbers, just to bring it all the way back to the first takeaway, do good work that is high quality consistently. And if you continue to show up and do that, the results will follow. That is all for this week. Thanks to you guys for listening. Again, big thanks to Cal Newport and Brad Stahlberg. We'll be back on Monday with another Coach Up. Until then, take care of yourselves. Have a good weekend. And as always, farewell.